Before I begin, I wish to thank David Krieger of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation for suggesting the topic of this talk, and Walter Cohn and David Gross for their kind hospitality here at the KITP. Furthermore, the staff of the KITP, Kevin Barron, Deborah Storm, Sarah Vaughn, and Kathy Hart, really are the ones that made this possible. The international community of physicists calls this the World Year of Physics. This grandiose term is meant to draw attention to the centennial of the remarkable accomplishments of Albert Einstein, who soared from the obscurity of a clerkship in the Swiss Patent Office in Bern to fame among scientists. During 1905, he published papers on the photoelectric effect, which suggested that light, earlier thought to be a continuum or a wave, consisted of particles of energy called quanta or photons, on Brownian motion, which established the reality of atoms and an idea of their dimensions, on the special theory of relativity, which denied that time was an absolute, and presented the world's most famous equation, E equals mc squared. Einstein's 1916 general theory of relativity, which claimed that light possesses mass and could be gravitationally bent by a massive object, was confirmed by data collected during a solar eclipse expedition just after World War I. Then his fame rocketed from the confines of his peer group to the general public. For the next four decades, his name and his reputation as a genius were known to multitudes who understood nothing about his science, but his image was well known, particularly his unruly halo of hair, and this was recognizable by the masses. Scientists prior to Hiroshima in 1945 were rarely public figures. They seldom made headlines, and when they were quoted, their remarks almost invariably were directed toward technical matters. Scientists admittedly had no expertise on political, social, cultural, or ethical topics, so why would they bother to speak publicly, and why would anyone bother to listen to them? Albert Einstein was virtually the only exception to this norm among scientists. He not only was outspoken on a number of non-technical matters, but his words were given widespread attention. More than anyone else, I believe that Einstein set the tone and changed the rules for social responsibility for his successors. After World War II, and not only because of Einstein, scientists left their ivory towers. Among their activities, they urged control of nuclear weapons by the United Nations. They lobbied for civilian, not military, management of the atom in the United States. They protested President Harry Truman's decision in 1950 to expand efforts to produce thermonuclear weapons. And they participated in advisory committees to the government from many organizations. In most cases, the subject of concern had a scientific or engineering connection. But the debates really were about political decisions. What was in the national interest or even the global interest? These activist scientists felt that they had as much right to speak as anyone else, and they consciously capitalized on their celebrity when advocating their non-scientific positions. Indeed, this was in the accepted tradition of baseball players promoting breakfast cereals without being experts on nutrition. In considering Albert Einstein the peacenik, I'm using what clearly was his own broad definition of peace. Peace for Einstein was more than the absence of war. It included not only arms control efforts, anti-militarism, anti-corporate profiteering on armaments, but also democracy, intellectual freedom, human rights, civil liberties, and social justice. Einstein was also a great iconoclast. both in science and in his public activities. He was his own man. And he was well aware of the irony of all the tribute paid to him over his lifetime. "To punish me for my contempt for authority," he said, "fate has made me an authority myself." These are not in the order that I hoped. Time magazine called Albert Einstein the person of the century, person of the 20th century, that is, indicating not only the personal stature gained through his scientific contributions, but also the importance of science to the world, both economically and for military purposes. Far more than any other century, science came to dominate the 20th, and Einstein was its unsurpassed symbol. Albert Einstein was born in Ulm, Germany in 1879 and died in Princeton, New Jersey in 1955. The world changed enormously during his lifetime, and he played no small part in this alteration. Einstein's 1905 work in theoretical physics was recognized as profound, even if it was not immediately and universally accepted. A few years later, he was appointed professor in Zurich, then Prague, then back to Zurich, and finally a special chair at the pinnacle of German science in Berlin in 1914. In 1919, his fame reached the wider public when it was shown by British astronomer Arthur Stanley Eddington that starlight was bent by the sun on its path to Earth, just as general relativity predicted. In 1922, he received the 1921 Nobel Prize for Physics, which had been held over for a year, not for his most famous work on relativity, but for the less controversial, a bit less, and much more accepted law of the photoelectric effect. So much a celebrity did Einstein become that he was Charlie Chaplin's personal guest of honor at the opening in 1931 of the film City Lights. The scientist and his wife Elsa received a standing ovation as they entered the theater. I think I'm getting two pictures going by it with one click now. Maybe I can go back. That's what I want. It's very sensitive. Okay. Yeah, let's leave it there. World War I began a mere 4 months after Einstein's arrival in Berlin, and his anti-militaristic attitude quickly asserted itself. But this was not a decision of the moment. Rather, Einstein had formed his views quite early in life. For example, he moved from Germany to Switzerland at age 16, deliberately to escape required military training. And while his outlook developed as different issues presented themselves, Einstein remained true to his original beliefs with few deviations. The conflict opened with the famous Guns of August. In October 1914, 93 German intellectuals and professors signed a so-called Manifesto to the Civilized World, denying that Germany was responsible for the war, for invading neutral Belgium, and for brutality against Belgian citizens, cities, and libraries. Such a disclaimer seemed to their enemies so contrary to the facts that people and nations of the Entente were astounded that intelligent and distinguished Germans could sign such a document. Anger followed surprise. The manifesto said nothing about science, but 22 of the 93 men were natural scientists and physicians, including some very, very prominent ones. Men who presumably knew something about documenting the truth. More than any action in the war, the manifesto became the symbol for Allied scientists' criticism. For Germany, it was an unintended consequence, as the manifesto was supposed to fracture the enemy, not unite them. Not all Germans approved of this manifesto. Georg Nicolai, professor of physiology at the University of Berlin, composed a counter-manifesto called Manifesto to Europeans that pleaded for an end to the conflict. He was joined only by Albert Einstein and two others. Nicolai was jailed for a few years, while Einstein's international fame seems to have preserved his liberty. Among German pacifists, who for a while were permitted to present their views, Einstein became a notable figure. Always the internationalist, he wrote to the Dutch physicist H.A. Lorentz in 1915 that it would seem that men always need some idiotic fiction in the name of which they can hate one another. Once it was religion, now it is the state, meaning nationalism. Speaking to students immediately after World War I, Einstein counseled democracy, not dictatorial violence. Force, he said, breeds only bitterness, hatred, and reaction. After the armistice, Einstein sought to convince the Allies to help feed the starving German population. He felt that the Allies would believe the truth of his reports. The victors, however, maintained a food blockade as a form of punishment. Einstein was involved also in an international effort by private citizens to examine the claims of atrocities against the German army, hoping to enlighten the German citizenry as to how others saw them, thereby leading to reconciliation. He continued to be a prominent spokesman for pacifism. Actions such as these exposed Einstein to the loathing of die-hard nationalists. Indeed, fearing that media attention that he received might encourage a reaction against his political views, Einstein, who recognized that he had no special expertise here, for a time limited his interviews and public statements. He also knew that right-wing extremists and anti-Semites had threatened to assassinate him. In the post-war period, while politicians urged reconciliation, scientists in the victorious countries continued a boycott of German scientists, purging them from old international organizations, denying them membership in newly created bodies such as the International Council of Scientific Unions, and barring their participation in international congresses. Einstein was perhaps the only scientist from Germany who was welcomed at these events. Desiring profoundly to improve relations among intellectuals, he nevertheless walked a fine line. If he was too friendly with Allied scientists, he was criticized at home as disloyal, while if he was too reserved, he alienated those who sought to honor him. When German science produced quantum mechanics in the mid to late 1920s, and the nation could no longer be ignored, the Germans insisted upon an apology if they were to rejoin the rest of world science, an apology which the other national bodies felt was undeserved. These negotiations continued up to the eve of World War II. The war to end all wars left Europe and the US exhausted. Pacifism, never widely embraced now, was respectable. Einstein, a pacifist, for once did not buck the tide. War Resisters International, the pacifist group, received his continued support. "My pacifism," Einstein remarked, "is an instinctive feeling, a feeling that possesses me. The thought of murdering another human being is abhorrent to me. My attitude is not the result of an intellectual theory, but is caused by a deep antipathy to every kind of cruelty and hatred." As an internationalist who felt that chauvinism was dangerous and that nations must relinquish some of their sovereignty for the greater good, he willingly became a member of the League of Nations Commission for Intellectual Cooperation. Other commission members at various times included Henri Bergson, Marie Curie, H.A. Lorentz, Paul Painlevé, Robert Millikan, and Gilbert Murray. However, within a year he resigned when France refused to arbitrate over German war reparations, and the League of Nations proved impotent in halting France's occupation of the Ruhr area. Later, he accepted an invitation to rejoin the commission, hoping that it would be taken as a step toward rapprochement. If Einstein's behavior sometimes seemed erratic, so too was his countrymen's view of him. Esteemed for the prestige his scientific work brought, he was vilified for his political views, and all the more so as he was outspoken. Einstein noted, "Strange people, these Germans. I am a foul-smelling flower to them, and yet they keep tucking me into their buttonholes." In a major statement of his views in 1930, published under the title, "The World as I See It," Einstein wrote, "This brings me to the worst outgrowth of herd life, the military system which I abhor. I feel only contempt for those who can take pleasure marching in rank and file to the strains of a band. Surely such men were given their great brain by mistake. The spinal cord would have aptly sufficed." Using his many invitations to scientific events worldwide, including repeated visits to Caltech and Pasadena and side trips to Santa Barbara, Einstein more and more presented additional lectures on pacifism. That's a famous one. To reject war, he urged young men to refuse to serve in the military. In New York in late 1930, he proposed a 2% solution. If 2% of those expected to fight refused, nations would be obliged to cease their aggressive behavior because they could not jail such large numbers of their young people. Often asked about the role of science in human life, Einstein noted that it could be used for good or bad purposes, but that it could play no part in organizing a peaceful society. Man's will was needed for that. In his view, nationalism was the major hurdle. Nationalism, Einstein said, is an infantile disease. It is the measles of mankind. Besides such new proposals as his 2% solution, Einstein embraced old ideas too, namely economic pressure. In early 1932, to constrain Japan's actions on the Asian mainland, he recommended an international economic boycott. To counter the worldwide depression, he urged an unselfish review of national economies, a revision of national economies, a more equitable distribution of wealth. Fundamentally, Einstein was a socialist, for he felt that was the most likely organization of society to protect the maximum number of people from exploitation and class divisions, and provide them with the greatest economic welfare and individual freedom. His socialism was not based on intellectual theories, but rather on his intuitive humanitarianism. He feared the concentration of power. The League of Nations proved ineffective in preventing Japan's invasion of Manchuria and Italy's attack on Ethiopia. Closer to home, Adolf Hitler became Chancellor of Germany in January 1933, epitomizing the period's rising tide of nationalism and the country's remilitarization in violation of the Versailles Treaty. Einstein now recognized that not only his freedom, but his life was in danger if he returned to Germany from a visit to the United States, for the Nazis put a price on his head. Curiously, Hitler's supporters criticized not only Einstein's person, but also his science, which they labeled Jewish physics. Despite the circumstance that Germany was the birthplace of Max Planck's quantum theory and Werner Heisenberg's quantum mechanics, leading experimental physicists, such as Nobel laureates Philipp Lenard and Johannes Stark, argued that theory was ruining the quality of German physics. An early foe of fascism, in Italy and elsewhere in Europe, Einstein could be counted on to sign appeals and to speak out against this threat to freedom. Hitler's aggressive behavior caused Einstein's pacifism profound discomfort. Ultimately, seeing no alternative, he urged military confrontation of Germany's leader. This striking change of attitude caused outrage among many inflexible pacifists, but Einstein felt that a new strategy was required. Even as he maintained his long-standing fundamental principle of pacifism. After the war, when the victorious Allies sought to build a democratic Germany, Italy, and Japan from their ruins, Einstein was almost alone in abstaining from intellectual rapprochement. So stunned was he by the enormity of the suffering and killing, and by the bestiality aimed at the Jews, that for the rest of his life he would have nothing to do with the land of his birth and opposed its remilitarization. Einstein attempted both to guide public opinion and to aid oppressed individuals. On October 3, 1933, for example, he addressed an audience of 10,000 people in London's Royal Albert Hall. This was a fundraiser for exiled scholars organized by several relief agencies. Cambridge University's Ernest Rutherford, the president of a refugee support group called the Academic Assistance Council, chaired the meeting. Now in need of employment himself, Einstein accepted a post on the founding faculty of the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, where the New Jersey legislature officially welcomed him, while a Princeton University alumnus damned this foreigner spouting, quote, communistic and pacifistic doctrines. Just as light exhibited wave and particle characteristics, the public reaction toward Einstein consistently showed a love-hate dualism. Reacting to the rise of anti-Semitism in Germany, Einstein turned strongly to Zionism. This was not a new cause for him, as he had accompanied Zionist leader Chaim Weizmann to the U.S. in 1921, seeking funds to create the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. This was his first trip to America, and he was lionized. The Spanish Civil War also captured Einstein's attention, and he vigorously called for aid to the anti-fascist forces fighting Franco, particularly the American volunteers in the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. Thanks to Hitler, Einstein was now a militant pacifist. In 1939, following the discovery in Germany of nuclear fission, he had no qualms in alerting President Franklin Roosevelt to the Nazis' probable quest for nuclear weapons. Previously, he had dismissed the likelihood of getting a net output of energy from so-called atom smashers, namely the particle accelerators such as the cyclotron. The bullets were too small and few, while the targets, atoms, were largely empty space. He famously likened the task to shooting birds in the dark in a country where there are not many birds. He made headlines with that. The discovery of nuclear fission at the end of 1938 changed everything. The tiny amount of mass that was lost in the process was translated by the E equals MC squared equation into an incredible amount of energy. Physicists the world over recognized immediately that both explosives and reactors were possible. Still, physicists did not expect these applications of nuclear energy to appear in their lifetimes. There were too many hurdles to overcome. Lacking the experience of chemists with a huge chemical engineering industry, physicists could not anticipate the enormous engineering project that the U.S. would undertake to make the bomb. Based solely on the potential threat of fission, Leo Szilard, assisted by Edward Teller and Eugene Wigner, prevailed upon Einstein to inform the president of this dangerous phenomenon known to the Germans. While this did ultimately lead to the Manhattan Project, there were many other paths by which the bomb would have been pursued in the U.S., even without Einstein's celebrated letter. Still, the letter and the E equals MC squared equation made it seem that Einstein was a major contributor to the atomic bomb's creation. This was ironic, for Einstein was, in fact, excluded from working on the Manhattan Project, which is documented in a letter from Vannevar Bush, director of the Office of Scientific Research and Development, saying in one part, the Navy gave its assent to Clarence, that is. But in a letter dated July 26, 1940, General Strong stated that the Army could not clear. Einstein could not get clearance from the Army to work on the Manhattan Project. He wasn't trusted. Because the bomb was a weapons development project, Army Intelligence, G2, was asked in 1940 to vet the scientists expected to participate. G2 requested and received considerable help from the FBI. At that time, the FBI file on Einstein was small. Most of it was material from the Woman Patriot Corporation. In particular, a 1932 pamphlet demanding that the U.S. deny entry to Einstein. The Woman Patriots were, quote, for the home and national defense, against women's suffrage, feminism, and socialism. They regarded foreign anarchists, communists, pacifists, and feminists as undesirable aliens. Einstein made their list by belonging to at least three of these groupings. The FBI file also claimed incorrectly that Einstein was a member of an international organizing committee for a 1932 World Congress Against War held in Amsterdam and sponsored by the Communist International or Comintern. Indeed, he supported the Congress's goals, but declined to attend or belong because of Soviet domination. These two examples of right-wing paranoid propaganda and of factual inaccuracies typify the content of FBI and G2 files. One may claim that they consist only of raw data, not careful analysis, but the circumstance that earlier documents were quoted in later reports not only repeated the errors, but made them seem proven overwhelmingly. This combination of truth and fiction accumulated. Einstein was associated with numerous Communist Front committees, leagues, and causes. Indeed, while he did address some of their meetings and did allow his prestigious name to appear on their stationery, he participated actively in very few. He was too much of a loner, too much his own man. Unaware of his FBI file and unaware that G2 had denied him security clearance about 2 months earlier, in October 1940, Einstein became an American citizen. Undoubtedly conscious that the government was organizing nuclear investigations, it must soon have become obvious to him that he would not be asked to participate. The Navy, in contrast, readily gave Einstein clearance, and he eagerly provided much appreciated calculations on explosives and anti-submarine warfare in the fight against the Nazis. Fred Jerome, the author of a book entitled The Einstein File, speculates that the Army excluded Einstein from the Manhattan Project not because of his alleged communist ties, nor because of the very real anti-Semitism in various branches of government, nor because nuclear physics was not Einstein's specialty. Jerome believes that the reason was J. Edgar Hoover's German sympathies and isolationist wishes. Einstein, the anti-Nazi and prominent anti-isolationist in 1940, must have been a problem to Hoover, who would have been inclined to block Einstein wherever possible. The Army went along with this, anticipating that Einstein was a prima donna who could be a problem if a policy dispute arose. Personally, I do not disagree with Jerome's analysis, but would place additional emphasis on Einstein's alleged communist connections. Known as a free thinker, he might not have followed government instructions to keep certain information secret. Conceivably, Einstein might have been considered a potential security risk. There is more to the idea of Einstein's leftist sympathies. Some thought that he actually was a Soviet agent. In the 1950s, the FBI and Army intelligence took seriously charges by an unnamed informant that Einstein's home office in Berlin was used as a drop by Comintern agents relaying messages from the Far East to the Kremlin in the late 1920s and early 1930s. The theory was that Einstein had so much international correspondence that these coded spy telegrams were not noticeable. Einstein and or his secretary Helen Dukas allegedly then gave the messages to couriers headed to Moscow. About the same time, the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service responded to Einstein's connections to many organizations that were labeled as communist or communist fronts by the House Committee on Un-American Activities, HUAC. The INS sought information from the FBI about him with the possible intent of revoking his citizenship and deporting him. And an informant alleged that Einstein, operating out of the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles, was the mastermind behind a communist plot to take over Hollywood. Neither the INS plans nor the Hollywood allegations seem to have gone further, although the INS did purge a quote by Einstein that it had used for over a decade in an orientation booklet for prospective citizens. The quote that they cut after thinking him a little too far left was, "Political liberty implies liberty to express one's political opinion orally and in writing, and a tolerant respect for any and every individual opinion." That's subversive. Like other U.S. government agencies of the period, the INS can be charged with intolerance, anti-Semitism, and a right-wing agenda. With Einstein's death in 1955 and the serious charges against him unsubstantiated, the FBI concluded its extensive file on him. We may laugh at the silliness of some accusations, mourn at the irrelevancy of others, or cry at the colossal waste of taxpayers' dollars on these investigations, but they do provide an accurate measure of the anti-communist hysteria of the 1950s and of J. Edgar Hoover's personal vendetta to discredit a prominent liberal. The threat of Hitler ended in 1945, but the enduring threat of nuclear weapons began that same year when the civilian targets of Hiroshima and Nagasaki were attacked. Shortly after the war, Einstein expressed his feelings. "In my opinion, the only salvation for civilization and the human race lies in the creation of a world government with security of nations founded upon law. As long as sovereign states continue to have separate armaments and armament secrets, new world wars will be inevitable." Because the new United Nations was a league of sovereign states, not a de facto government, it possessed no supranational power to prevent conflict, and Einstein had misgivings about its value. Sometimes the Holocaust seemed to be in the back of his mind. "I am not what you might call a religious pacifist," he wrote. "Besides, I consider it preferable for men to fight rather than to allow themselves to be butchered without lifting a finger." This was just about the alternative in the case of Hitler. "Nor do I favor unilateral disarmament. What I advocate is an armed peace under supranational control." Einstein, now in his mid-60s and not in the best of health, did nevertheless assume the visible role of chairman of the Emergency Committee of Atomic Scientists, a group founded in the spring of 1946 to raise funds for educational purposes, such as supporting publication of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. In a fundraising telegram sent to several hundred people, Einstein made a Delphic statement that has become so famous it appears on bumper stickers. "The unleashed power of the atom has changed everything save our modes of thinking, and thus we drift toward unparalleled catastrophe." Less oracular, in the telegram's next sentence, Einstein clearly stated the scientists' obligation. "We scientists who unleash this immense power have an overwhelming responsibility in this world life and death struggle to harness the atom for the benefit of mankind and not for humanity's destruction." As the Cold War became more intense, Einstein again departed from his pacifist ideas and agreed that the U.S. needed the A-bomb to deter a nuclear attack by another nation, but deterrence was its only purpose. The War Resisters League in New York tried in 1948 to re-enlist Einstein in their efforts toward nonviolence. "Times had changed," he replied, "from the pre-Hitler period when he had urged people to decline to participate in war preparations and military activities. Now, with many undemocratic nations around the world, the war resistance movement," he said, "actually serves to weaken the nations with a more liberal type of government, and indirectly to support the policies of the existing tyrannical governments." Instead, Einstein reiterated his belief that the establishment of world government offers greater hope of success. But as he always recognized, the supranational solution would have to be done in a way that encouraged the Soviets to participate willingly and not regard the effort as a coalition against the USSR. Further, he remained opposed to universal military training, much discussed around 1948, seeing it as unnecessary and likely to increase tension, but more seriously because it would, quote, generate that militaristic spirit among the people which in the past has become fatal to many nations. This example, one of a great many, illustrates that Einstein was alert to his times, was ready to change his mind, in this case about war resistance, hoped to be effective, and declined a great many of the invitations that poured into his home in Princeton. He did not object to tilting against some windmills, but chose not to be a Don Quixote flailing against universal injustice. Nuclear weapons were not the only new problem in the interaction between scientists and government, although they were clearly representative of awkward issues raised. After World War II, the federal government was the only source wealthy enough to fund the majority of the nation's scientific activity, and most of this funding came from military agencies. To some, such as mathematician Norbert Wiener, this was inappropriate, and he avoided military support. Others had no difficulty with military support, especially as an enlightened Office of Naval Research willingly provided funds for basic as well as applied research. Still others looked to non-military federal funding. Einstein recognized the inadequacy of private sources of funding, was comfortable with federal support of science, but he drew the line at assistance from the armed forces, seeing in such activity seeds of the militarism he had opposed all his life. In response to the first test of a fission weapon by the Soviet Union in August 1949, President Truman announced at the end of January 1950 a crash program to develop fusion weapons, or hydrogen bombs. A number of prominent scientists opposed this step, arguing that such large explosions were unnecessary. The atomic bombs in the arsenal were adequate for the job. Also that hydrogen bombs were immoral, as they would be used against civilian targets, cities. Einstein made his own position known in a filmed talk on a television show hosted by Eleanor Roosevelt. He called it an illusion to think that we could permanently assure security through military force, whatever the cost. Yet in our search for security, the U.S. constructed bases around the world and strengthened potential allies. The arms race between the United States and the Soviet Union, he said, initiated originally as a preventive measure. Now it assumes historical proportions. And now the public has been advised that the production of the hydrogen bomb is the new goal, which will probably be accomplished. If these efforts should prove successful, radioactive poisoning of the atmosphere, and hence annihilation of all life on Earth, will have been brought within the range of what is technically possible. America's reaction to the Cold War, Einstein believed, was a combination of fear and arrogance, which prevented the formation of sane opinion. The New York World Telegram singled out Einstein from the many scientists opposed to fusion weapon development, calling him extremely naive and too closely connected with Communist Front propaganda, despite the fact that Einstein declined to support many organizations and conferences because he felt they were controlled by the Kremlin. The World Telegram editorial discounted his advice. It said, if the hydrogen bomb is as dangerous as Dr. Einstein fears, he may rest assured that America will never be the first to loose such a dread weapon upon the world. Should the Soviets get thermonuclear weapons, however, civilization can have no such guarantees. Einstein's carefully selected yet generous willingness to lend his name to public statements in opposition to government policies, as well as to speak out on his own, as above, made him an actual target for criticism. Submission to the law of the land must not be blind, he controversially stated. In the event of a conflict, the moral law of conscience takes precedence over one's obligations to the state. Einstein never relented in urging control of the atom. We scientists, he said, whose tragic destination has been to help in making the methods of annihilation more gruesome and more effective, must consider it our solemn and transcendent duty to do all in our power in preventing these weapons from being used. He admitted that scientists felt responsibility, even guilt, for their work on the bomb. But he denied that he himself felt guilt, for he did not participate in that effort. He called his letter to President Roosevelt, alerting him to Germany's potential to make a uranium weapon, a great mistake, but a reasonable action in view of the danger of Nazism. Indeed, had he known that Germany would not make an atomic bomb, he would not have written to the president. Nuclear weapons ultimately would have been developed, he conceded, but perhaps somewhat later. Besides his anti-nuclear efforts, Einstein was notably vocal on other issues. He repeatedly protested racism in America, from the campaign to save the Scottsboro Boys of the 1930s, to the murder of blacks, often with the connivance of police, in the post-war period, and was invited by singer Paul Robeson in 1946 to serve with him as co-chair of the American Crusade to End Lynching. When contralto Marian Anderson gave a sold-out concert on the Princeton campus in 1937, she was denied a room in the Nassau Inn, a local hotel. Instead, she accepted Einstein's invitation to stay in his home. During the war years, Einstein was a sponsor of the new defense fund created by the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. To highlight his support of blacks, Einstein accepted honorary degrees from their institutions, such as one from Lincoln University in 1946. Every citizen, he noted, must be guaranteed protection against acts of violence. Speaking in 1950 at a meeting in Atlanta of anti-racist educators, Einstein said that every right-minded person will be grateful to you for having united to fight this evil that so grievously injures the dignity and the repute of our country. These and similar anti-racist activities, in which Einstein's name figured prominently, were deemed to follow the Communist Party line. Einstein's FBI file grew accordingly, as the Bureau considered communism, not domestic criminals, as its primary foe. Through the Freedom of Information Act, much of Einstein's FBI file has been released, albeit with huge sections erased. You can, in fact, buy its 1,800-plus pages on a reel of microfilm. I think it only costs about $85. Virtually every alleged red or pink organization with which he was affiliated was investigated, including anti-fascist groups during World War II. The FBI engaged in mail opening, listening to phone conversations, examining garbage, and breaking into homes and offices. After the war, direct surveillance of Einstein began, although the Attorney General denied J. Edgar Hoover's request to tap the scientist's telephone. Nonetheless, the FBI's Newark office, acting independently, did listen to his conversations. What was the purpose of such efforts? At first, it was perhaps because the FBI believed that he was privy to the secrets of the bomb. And indeed, a procession of scientists from communist countries paraded through Princeton to pay homage to Einstein, enough to trigger the government's concern. But when the FBI was corrected and recognized that he played no role in designing nuclear weapons, it seems as if inertia kept the surveillance in place. Then, as the 1940s ended, and as the House Committee on Un-American Activities and its clones in various state houses ramped up their operations, Einstein was labeled as an atomic spy by a former investigator for HUAC. Illogical and incorrect, it was enough to justify the FBI's continuing attention. The amount of drivel in Einstein's FBI file, collected by supposedly intelligent agents, is astonishing. One item, for example, notes that he sent greetings to a large meeting in Madison Square Garden that endorsed cooperation between Washington and Moscow. The event occurred in November 1945, and others who sent greetings included Eleanor Roosevelt, General Eisenhower, Admiral King, Secretary of War Patterson, and President Truman himself. But it seems that J. Edgar Hoover was not inclined to follow national policy, Instead, he wished to maintain the earlier inclination to regard as subversive anyone who was favorable to the Kremlin. Indeed, Hoover's desire soon bore fruit, following Winston Churchill's Iron Curtain speech and other events in 1946 and after that initiated the Cold War. Before long, the Cold War was linked to a domestic Red Scare in the United States, but not, it should be noted, in other Western countries. In the decade between the end of World War II and Einstein's death in 1955, he supported, for example, an international cultural and social and scientific conference for world peace, protested against HUAC's attack on the Joint Anti-Fascist Refugee Committee, protested the government's detention on Ellis Island of alleged French Communist Party member and distinguished scientist, Irène Joliot-Curie, the daughter of Marie Curie, joined with astronomer Harlow Shapley and several others to create the Committee of 1000, whose goal was the abolition of HUAC, petitioned the Supreme Court to strike down the prison sentences given the Hollywood 10 for contempt of Congress, protested the trial of the leaders of the American Communist Party, a legal political party in that period, supported Henry Wallace's third party, the Progressive Party, run for the presidency in 1948, criticized capitalism as a failure, appealed for clemency for Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, and much, much more. One of the early victims of the Red Scare was physicist E.U. Condon, director of the National Bureau of Standards and president of the American Physical Society in 1946. Because of his membership in the American Soviet Science Society, and despite repeated clearances by various government agencies both before and after this date, Condon was denounced in March 1948 by HUAC as, quote, one of the weakest links in our atomic security. Scientists, including Einstein, rallied to his defense. The smear by HUAC was deplored by the Emergency Committee of Atomic Scientists, the Federation of American Scientists, the National Academy of Sciences, the American Physical Society, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the entire physics faculty at Harvard, and by other groups of scientists. In this election year of 1948, President Truman courageously appeared at the AAAS centennial celebrations, condemned HUAC's excesses, and notably shared the platform with Condon. Einstein charged that HUAC was, quote, an incomparably greater danger to our society than those few communists in the country could ever be. These investigations have already undermined to a considerable extent the democratic character of our society. Such attacks on scientists as subversives continued, and Einstein was a reliable supporter of those unfairly targeted. Just as in 1930 he urged men to refuse to serve in the military, in 1953 he notoriously urged intellectuals not to cooperate with congressional investigating committees. Every intellectual who is called before one of the committees, he wrote, ought to refuse to testify, i.e., he must be prepared for jail and economic ruin, in short, for the sacrifice of his personal welfare in the interest of the cultural welfare of his country. This kind of inquisition violates the spirit of the Constitution, and a few did follow Einstein's advice. For his defiance of Congress, Einstein was criticized in a publication of the California Republican Party, which called him, quote, a freeloading refugee who took more from America than he gave and who now betrayed his adopted country. Earlier in 1949, Life magazine placed Einstein among 50 notable dupes and fellow travelers who dress up communist fronts. Recall that in this period around 1950, loyalty oaths and blacklists were common. School teachers were widely questioned about their political views, and reactionary school boards not only removed books from school libraries, as did the Voice of America, but on occasion burned the offending books. To Einstein, this was all too reminiscent of the Nazi bonfires two decades earlier. Even the story of Robin Hood was claimed to be communist propaganda by an Indiana official. After all, he stole from the rich and gave to the poor. But this book was spared when the current sheriff of Nottingham assured a reporter that Robin Hood was not a communist. Note that by about 1954, critics of McCarthy and the congressional investigating committees grew louder and more widespread. Yet Einstein seems to have been the only voice to counsel civil disobedience. Toward the end of 1954, a year in which the Atomic Energy Commission publicly humiliated Robert Oppenheimer by withdrawing his security clearance, and many pundits wondered aloud whether scientists would be willing to advise a government that treated advice it did not like as disloyalty, Einstein made his famous plumber statement. If I would be a young man again and had to decide how to make my living, I would not try to become a scientist or scholar or teacher. I would rather choose to be a plumber or a peddler in the hope to find that modest degree of independence still available under present circumstances. Thus, Einstein distinguished between those whose work led them to question society and those whose work involved no such concern. Peace activists often have a hard time determining if their labors are effective. They rarely see desired legislation passed and infrequently can claim to have altered a government's position. At best, they usually resort to the belief that without their efforts, it would have been worse. In Einstein's case, we have much the same problem. Einstein's fame meant that he could capture headlines. Public policy was not changed immediately, but it seems clear that Einstein's known positions on the dignity of the individual, democratic processes, and intellectual freedom helped to mobilize public opinion. But if we find it somewhat difficult to specify the positive consequences for society of Einstein's peacenik actions, it is sadly rather easy to point to the negative consequences for Einstein personally. In Germany in the 1920s and 30s, he lived in danger of assassination. In the interwar period, American so-called patriotic groups urged the government to deny him visas to enter the country. During World War II, he was blocked from working on the Manhattan Project. Post-war, FBI surveillance of his alleged communist sympathies intensified, and the INS contemplated stripping him of U.S. citizenship. Throughout, he was vilified in editorials. That he remained indifferent to personal attacks and continued to be outspoken in his beliefs testifies to his remarkable personal courage. Physicist Peter Bergman once asked Einstein how to design a research project. Always the individualist, Einstein replied that, "In this business, everyone, for God's sake, has to make his own decisions. Literally, has to hatch his own eggs." Einstein marched through the first half of the 20th century, and a bit more, being true to himself on a remarkably wide range of topics, both scientific and political, making decisions that were carefully considered and eloquently expressed. Indeed, he hatched a remarkable number of his own eggs. Thank you. I'd be happy to take questions if you have any.
It's time for three questions. Speak into the mic so that the questions.
There is a mic somewhere there.
Everyone will probably laugh at the one photograph with Einstein wearing tails. He was at the beach, I believe, and I wonder what the occasion was that he went to that he was wearing tails for.
Oh, I think they're just a long coat. Wasn't that a long coat on the beach?
It was a very long coat. I thought it was a tuxedo or a.
I don't believe it was tails. So he wore tails on various other occasions, but no, I think that beach picture was simply a long coat.
I'm curious as to what sort of events he would go to where he would dress up so nicely. I generally don't think of scientists wearing tuxedos and tails.
Well, not only the Nobel Prize celebration, but in the earlier part of the 20th century, formal dress was the norm at a number of events. Wasn't he wearing a tux at in the picture with Max Planck, where he?
The shirt collar was up.
Well, that was a common. Those kind of wing collars and ties were common, even if it wasn't formal dress. But for prize celebrations or certain meetings, he might have worn tux. He, as you probably know, did not like to wear socks. Because he thought it was unreasonable to ask his wife or his secretary assistant Helen Dukas to mend the holes that would inevitably come in the socks. And he made a comment to the effect that the appearance isn't so important. He says, you don't care so much about the paper that wraps the meat, you care about the meat inside that's more important.
Considering the way that Einstein was treated in the post-war period, all the vilification, surveillance, and so forth, I'm wondering whether he ever seriously considered leaving the country and going somewhere else. Do you have any indication that ever...
He would not have gone to Germany because he avoided Germany rigorously, avoided any kind of contact. He was, in fact, asked by the president of West Germany to rejoin a certain group of most honored people in the country. And he said, no, I won't have anything to do with the country. But as far as going to other countries, he had strong ties to the Netherlands because of the presence there early in the century of H.A. Lorentz, whom he regarded as the greatest scientist he knew, and Paul Ehrenfest, who was a very close friend. He was offered positions there. In the early 30s, he was offered positions in Spain, he was always offered a position at Hebrew University, but he had violent disagreements about policy there with the powers that were at the time in charge. He could have gone to a number of places. I don't know the details, but I've read some allegations that suggest that he could have gone to Caltech permanently, because when the Princeton Institute for Advanced Study was founded in the early 30s by Abraham Flexner, using Bamberger money, the department store money. Flexner apparently had some bitter quarrels with Robert Millikan at Caltech. Millikan perhaps thought that Flexner was stealing his star from him. So I don't know all the details, and I don't know how, I don't know whether Caltech would have given him a permanent position, but the position he accepted initially at the Princeton Institute was supposed to be only for half a year. As soon as Hitler came to power, then it effectively converted to a full-time position. Microphone.
Is it true that he was offered the presidency of Israel at one time?
That's true, yes. In 1952 or 3, when Chaim Weizmann died, Ben-Gurion was the prime minister, and he felt that he was obligated to offer the presidency to the greatest Jew on earth, perhaps the greatest Jew of all time. Through Abba Ibon, the ambassador in America, he contacted Einstein, who was stunned at the thought, but apparently this there was some press leakage, so Einstein had some intimation of it a day or so before he received the emissary from Abba Ibon. And he said, no, he said, I just don't have the people skills to perform the role of the president of Israel. Ben-Gurion would have loved to have the distinction of Einstein's fame, his person, as president of Israel, but he commented to his then private secretary, who later himself became president of Israel, what do I do if he accepts? But Einstein was smart enough to realize that it would not be an appropriate position for him. He would not do well. So he voted, and he was a loner. He was a person who liked his solitude. He was extremely courteous to almost anybody who would knock on his door. He was generous, friendly, but he really wanted to be alone to do his own work to the greatest extent. An example of his courtesy and friendliness, at Christmas time one year while he was living in Princeton, some carolers came to his door and began playing music, singing, and they had some musical instruments. And he walked out in a light sweater and said, may I play the violin? So I took the violin from the owner, and he joined them and played along with them. By contrast, Thomas Mann, who was also living in Princeton at that time and who had some contact with Einstein, never came to his door when the carolers came there. So this was the difference that the people in Princeton recognized, that he was part of their community and that they enjoyed him. Yes? Mike?
And I'm sorry, any comment on Einstein's relationship with Kurt Gödel?
All I can say is read the February 22nd issue of New Yorker this year. It's a lovely story in there of Einstein and Gödel, famous mathematician at the Princeton Institute, who used to walk back and forth together, and he was one of his closest friends there. I can't say anything more, but the author of that article did a very fine job.
Given all the concern about Einstein's political views, was he ever asked to testify before the House Un-American Activities Committee? He certainly advised other people not to testify there. And if he wasn't asked, what protected him?
To the best of my knowledge, he was not asked. And I think that it was probably the good sense of the congressman on HUAC or the senators and the Senate Internal Investigating Subcommittee not to call him, because they probably recognized that he would get more sympathy and they less. So you don't ask a witness who may upstage you. And I think that they feared that. They could easily have cited him for contempt of Congress or something like that, for telling witnesses not to testify, to just refuse. This is in the New York Times, and there were a few people who refused to testify and said, Albert Einstein advised me not to testify. You know, that's good evidence. And they didn't act upon it. Moreover, he was ill for the last decade or so of his life, if not longer, and he might have begged off on medical reasons. I don't know, but I'm not aware that he ever was cited or subpoenaed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Before you leave, there are refreshments outside, and then there are two other things here that you will want to know about. Upstairs, there's an exhibit of posters of about Einstein's life from the American Physical Society, I believe. No? Oh, it's the Institute. National Endowment of the Arts. Anyway, there's posters of his aspects of Einstein's life, and there's also an exhibition of photography, actually micrography, that is photographs taken with a microscope by Roman Vishniak that are very interesting, and I recommend that you go upstairs and see them. Thank you for coming.